Lois. Lois, can you hear me? I'm sorry. She looked up at him dazedly. A woman who had blasted forward from 40 to 60 in a matter of seconds, and then right past it and into her 70s, like a rocket overshooting its intended target. She tried a smile that didn't work very well. Lois, I'm sorry. I didn't know, and once I did, I couldn't stop. Lachesis. If you're to have any chance at all, Ralph, you must go now. He's almost here. Lois was nodding agreement. Go on, Ralph. I'm just weak, that's all. I'll be fine. I'm just going to sit here until my strength comes back. Her eyes shifted to the left, and Ralph followed her gaze. He saw the wino they'd frightened away earlier. He had returned to inspect the litter baskets at the top of the hill for returnable cans and bottles. And although his aura did not look as healthy as that of the fellow they had met out by the old train yards earlier, Ralph reckoned he would do in a pinch, which for Lois this definitely was. Clotho.
We'll see that he wanders over this way, Ralph. We don't have much power over the physical aspects of the short-time world, but I think we can manage that much.
You sure?
Yes.
Okay, good. Ralph took a quick look at the two little men, noted their anxious, frightened eyes, and nodded. Then he bent and kissed Lois's cool, wrinkled cheek. She gave him the smile of a tired old grandmother. I did that to her, he thought. Me. Then you'd better make sure you didn't do it for nothing, Carolyn's voice responded tartly. Ralph gave the three of them, Clotho and Lachesis were now flanking Lois protectively on the bench, a final glance, and then began to walk down the hill again. When he reached the toilets, he stood between them for a moment, then leaned his head against the one marked Women. He heard nothing when he tipped his head against the blue plastic wall of Men. However, he heard a faint, droning voice raised in song. Who believes that my wildest dreams and my craziest schemes will come true? You, baby, nobody but you. Christ, he's nuttier than a fruitcake. This is news, sweetheart? Ralph supposed it wasn't. He walked around to the door of the Portisan and opened it. Now he could also hear the distant, waspy buzz of an airplane engine. But there was nothing to see that he hadn't seen dozens of times before. The cracked toilet seat resting askew over the hole in the seat. A roll of toilet paper with a strange and somehow ominous swelled look. And to the left, a urinal that looked like a plastic teardrop. The walls were tangles of graffiti. The largest and most exuberant had been printed in foot-high red letters above the urinal. Tony Boynton has got the tightest little buns in Derry. A cloying pine-scented deodorizer overlay the smells of shit, piss, and lingering wino farts like makeup on the face of a corpse. The voice he was hearing seemed to come from the hole in the center of the Portisan's bench seat. Or perhaps it was seeping out of the very walls. From the time I fall asleep until the morning comes, I dream about you, baby. Nobody but you. Where is he? Ralph wondered. And how the hell do I get to him? Ralph felt sudden heat against his hip. It was as if someone had slipped a warm coal into his watch pocket. He began to frown, then remembered what was in there. He reached into the scrap of a pocket with one finger, touched the gold band he had stowed there, and hooked it out. He laid it on his palm, over the place where his love line and lifeline diverged, and poked at it gingerly. It had cooled again. Ralph found he wasn't very surprised. HD, ED, 8587. One ring to rule them all? One ring to bind them? Ralph murmured and slipped Ed's wedding band onto the third finger of his own left hand. It was a perfect fit. He pushed it up until it clinked softly against the wedding ring Carolyn had put onto his own finger some 45 years ago. Then he looked up and saw that the back wall of the Portisan had disappeared. What he saw, framed by the walls which did remain, was a just-past sunset sky and a swatch of Maine countryside fading into a blue-gray twilight haze. He estimated that he was looking out from a height of about 10,000 feet. He could see glimmering lakes and ponds and vast stretches of dark green woodland scrolling down toward the portisan's bench seat, and then disappearing. Far ahead, up toward the roof of the toilet cubicle, Ralph could see a glimmering nest of lights. That was probably Derry, now no more than 10 minutes away. In the lower left quadrant of this vision, Ralph could see part of an instrument panel. Taped over the altimeter was a small color photograph that stopped his breath. It was Helen, looking impossibly happy and impossibly beautiful. Cradled in her arms was the exalted and revered baby, fast asleep and no more than 4 months old. He wants them to be the last thing he sees in this world, Ralph thought. He's been turned into a monster, but I guess even monsters don't forget how to love. Something on the instrument panel began to beep. A hand came into view and flicked a switch. Before it disappeared, Ralph could see the white indentation on the third finger of that hand, faint but still visible, where the wedding ring had rested for at least 6 years. He saw something else as well. The aura surrounding the hand was the same as the one which had surrounded the thunderstruck baby in the hospital elevator, a turbulent, rapidly moving membrane that seemed as alien as the atmosphere of a gas giant. Ralph looked back once and raised his hand. Clotho and Lachesis raised theirs in return. Lois blew him a kiss. Ralph made a catching gesture, then turned and stepped into the portisan. He hesitated for a moment, wondering what to do about the bench seat, then remembered the oncoming hospital gurney, which should have crushed their skulls but hadn't, and walked toward the back of the cubicle. He clenched his teeth, preparing to bark his shin. What you knew was one thing, what you believed after 70 years of bumping into stuff quite another, and then stepped through the bench seat as if it were made of smoke, or as if he were. There was a scary sensation of weightlessness and vertigo, and for a moment he was sure he was going to vomit. This was accompanied by a feeling of drain, as if much of the power he had taken in from Lois was now being siphoned off. He supposed it was. This was a form of teleportation, after all, fabulous science fiction stuff, and something like that had to use up a lot of energy. The vertigo passed, but it was replaced by a perception that was even worse, a feeling that he had been split at the neck somehow. He realized he now had a completely unobstructed view of a whole sprawling section of the world. Jesus Christ, what's happened to me? What's wrong? His senses reluctantly reported back that there was nothing wrong exactly. It was just that he had achieved a position which should have been impossible. He was 73 inches tall. The cockpit of the plane was 60 inches from floor to ceiling. This meant that any pilot much bigger than Clotho and Lachesis had to slouch his way to his seat. Ralph, however, had entered the plane not only while it was in flight, but while he was standing up, and he was still standing up, between and slightly behind the two seats in the cockpit. The reason his view was unobstructed was both simple and horrible. His head was sticking out of the top of the plane. Ralph had a nightmare image of his old dog Rex, who'd like to ride with his head out the passenger window and his raggedy ears blowing back in the slipstream. He closed his eyes. What if I fall? If I can stick my head out through the damn roof, what's to keep me from sliding right down through the floor and falling all the way to the ground? Or maybe through the ground, and then through the very earth itself? But that wasn't happening. And nothing like it would happen, not on this level. All he had to do was remember the effortless way they'd risen through the floors of the hospital, and the ease with which they'd stood on the roof. If he kept those things in mind, he would be okay. Ralph tried to center on that idea, and when he felt quite sure he had himself under control, he opened his eyes again. Sloping out just below him was the plane's windshield. Beyond it was the nose, tipped with a quick silver blur of propeller. The nestle of lights he had observed from the door of the portisan was closer now. Ralph bent his knees, and his head slid smoothly through the ceiling of the cockpit. For a moment, he could taste oil in his mouth, and the tiny hairs in his nose seemed to bristle as if with an electric shock. And then he was kneeling between the pilot's and co-pilot's seats. He didn't know what he had expected to feel. Seeing Ed again after all this time and under such extravagantly weird circumstances. But the pang of regret, not just pity, but regret, which came was a surprise. He was wearing an old T-shirt instead of an Oxford or Arrow, with buttons up the front and a fruit loop on the back. And it had had an extraordinary effect, making him look not emaciated, but somehow heroic in a gothic romantic way. Ralph was forcefully reminded of Carolyn's favorite poem, The Highwayman by Alfred Noyes. Ed's skin was as pale as paper, his green eyes both dark and light, like emeralds in moonlight, Ralph thought, behind the small round John Lennon spectacles, his lips so red they looked as if they'd been rouged. He had tied the white silk scarf with its red Japanese characters around his forehead, so that the fringed ends trailed down his back. Within the thunderbolt swirls of his aura, Ed's intelligent, mobile face was filled with terrible regret and fierce determination. He was beautiful, beautiful, and Ralph felt a sense of déjà vu twist through him. Now he knew what he had glimpsed on the day he'd stepped between Ed and the man from Westside Gardeners. He was seeing it again, looking at Ed lost inside a typhoon aura from which no balloon string floated. Was like looking at a priceless Ming vase which had been thrown against a wall and shattered. At least he can't see me, not on this level. At least I don't think he can. As if in response to this thought, Ed turned and glanced directly at Ralph. His eyes were wide and full of mad caution. The corners of his finely molded mouth quivered and gleamed with buds of saliva. Ralph recoiled, momentarily positive that he was being seen. But Ed didn't react to Ralph's sudden backward movement. He threw a suspicious glance into the empty four-seat passenger cabin behind him instead, as if he had heard the stealthy movements of a stowaway. At the same time, he reached past Ralph and put his right hand on a cardboard carton which had been seat-belted into the co-pilot's chair. The hand caressed the box briefly, then went to his forehead and made some tiny adjustment to the scarf serving him as a headband. That done, he resumed singing. Only this time it was a different song, one that sent a tremor zigzagging up Ralph's back. One pill makes you bigger, one pill makes you small, and the ones that Mother gives you don't do anything at all. Right, Ralph thought. Go ask Alice when she's 10 feet tall. His heart was trip-hammering in his chest. Having Ed suddenly turn around like that had scared him in a way, even finding himself riding along at 10,000 feet with his head sticking out of the top of the plane hadn't been able to do. Ed didn't see him. Ralph was almost positive of that. But whoever had said that the senses of lunatics were more acute than those of the sane must have known what he was talking about, because Ed sure had an idea that something had changed. The radio squawked, making both men jump. This is for the Cherokee over South Haven. You're on the edge of Derry airspace at an altitude which requires a filed flight plan. Repeat, you're about to enter a controlled airspace over a municipal area. Get your hot dogging butt up to 16,000 feet, Cherokee, and come to 170. That's 170. While you're doing it, please identify yourself and state... Ed closed his hand into a fist and began to hammer the radio with it. Glass flew. Soon blood also began to fly. It spattered the instrument panel, the picture of Helen and Natalie, and Ed's clean gray T-shirt. He went on hammering until the voice on the radio first began to fade into a rising roar of static, and then quit altogether. Good, he said, in the low, sighing voice of a man who talks to himself a lot. Lots better. I hate all those questions. They just... He caught sight of his bloody hand and broke off. He held it up, looked at it more closely, and then rolled it into a fist again. A large sliver of glass was sticking out of his pinky just below the third knuckle. Ed pulled it free with his teeth, spat it casually aside, then did something which chilled Ralph's heart. Drew the side of his bloody fist first down his left cheek and then his right, leaving a pair of red marks. He reached into the elasticized pocket built into the wall on his left, pulled out a hand mirror, and used it to check his makeshift war paint. What he saw seemed to please him, because he smiled and nodded before returning the mirror to the pocket.
"Just remember what the Dormouse said,"
Ed advised himself in his low, sighing voice, and then pushed in on the control wheel. The Cherokee's nose dropped, and the altimeter slowly began to unwind. Ralph could see Derry straight ahead now. The city looked like a handful of opals scattered across dark blue velvet. There was a hole in the side of the carton in the co-pilot's seat. Two wires came out of it. They led into the back of a doorbell taped to the arm of Ed's seat. Ralph supposed that as soon as he had a visual on the Civic Center and actually began his kamikaze run, Ed would settle one finger on the raised white button in the middle of the plastic rectangle, and just before the plane hit, he would push it. "Ding dong, Avon calling." "Break those wires, Ralph. Break them." An excellent idea with only one drawback. He couldn't break so much as a strand of cobweb while he was on this level. That meant dropping back down to short-time country. And he was preparing to do just that when a soft, familiar voice on his right spoke his name.
"Ralph."
To his right? That was impossible. There was nothing on his right but the co-pilot's seat, the side of the aircraft, and leagues of twilit New England air. The scar along his arm had begun to tingle like a filament in an electric heater.
"Ralph."
"Don't look. Don't pay any attention at all. Ignore it." But he couldn't. Some great brick-like force had come to bear on him, and his head began to turn. He fought it, aware that the airplane's angle of descent was growing steeper. But it did no good.
"Ralph, look at me. Don't be afraid."
He made one last effort to disobey the voice and was unable. His head went on turning, and Ralph suddenly found himself looking at his mother, who had died of lung cancer 25 years ago. Bertha Roberts sat in her bentwood rocker, about 5 feet beyond where the side wall of the Cherokee's cockpit had been, knitting and rocking back and forth on thin air a mile or so above the ground. The slippers Ralph had given her for her 50th birthday, lined with real mink they had been, how goofy, were on her feet. A pink shawl was thrown around her shoulders. An old political button, "Win with Wilkie," it said, held the shawl closed. That's right, Ralph thought. She wore them as jewelry. It was her little affectation. I'd forgotten that. The only thing that struck a wrong note, other than that she was dead and currently rocking at 6,000 feet, was the bright red piece of Afghan in her lap. Ralph had never seen his mother knit, wasn't even sure she knew how, but she was knitting furiously just the same. The needles gleamed and winked as they shuttled through the stitches. "Mother? Mom? Is it really you?" The needles paused as she looked up from the crimson blanket in her lap. Yes, it was his mother, the version Ralph remembered from his teens anyway. Narrow face, high scholar's brow, brown eyes, and a bun of salt and pepper hair rolled tightly at the nape of the neck. It was her small mouth, which looked mean and ungenerous until it smiled, that was. "Why, Ralph Roberts, I'm surprised that you even have to ask." That's not really an answer, though, is it? Ralph thought. He opened his mouth to say so, and then decided it might be wiser, for the time being at least, to keep quiet. A milky shape was now swimming in the air to her right. When Ralph looked at it, it darkened and solidified into the cherry-stained magazine stand he had made her in woodshop during his sophomore year at Derry High. It was filled with Reader's Digests and Life magazines. And now the ground far below her began to disappear into a pattern of brown and dark red squares that spread out from the rocker in a widening ring like a pond ripple. Ralph recognized it at once. The kitchen linoleum of the house on Richmond Street in Marymead, the one where he'd grown up. At first he could see the ground through it, geometries of farmland, and not far ahead, the Kanduskeag flowing through Derry, and then it solidified. A ghostly shape like a big milkweed puff became his mom's old Angora cat, Futsy, curled up on the windowsill and looking out at the gulls circling above the old dump in the barrens. Futsy had died around the time Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis had stopped making movies together.
That old man was right, boy. You've no business messing into long-time affairs. Pay attention to your mother and stay out of what doesn't concern you. Mind me now.
Pay attention to your mother? Mind me now? Those words had pretty well summed up Bertha Roberts's views on the art and science of child-rearing, hadn't they? Whether it was in order to wait an hour after eating before taking a swim, or to make sure that old thief Butch Bowers didn't put a lot of rotten potatoes at the bottom of the peck basket she'd sent you to fetch, the prologue, pay attention to your mother, and the epilogue, mind me now, were always the same. And if you failed to pay attention, if you failed to mind her, you had to face the wrath of mother, and God help you then. She picked up the needles and began to knit again, running off scarlet stitches with fingers that looked faintly red themselves. Ralph supposed that was just an illusion. Or maybe the dye wasn't completely color-fast, and some of it was coming off on his fingers. His fingers? What a silly mistake that was. Her fingers. Except, well, there were little bunches of whiskers at the corners of her mouth. Long ones. Nasty somehow. And unfamiliar. Ralph could remember a fine down on her upper lip, but whiskers? No way. Those were new. New? New? What are you thinking about? She died 2 days after Robert Kennedy was assassinated in Los Angeles. So what in the name of God can be new about her? Two converging walls had bloomed on either side of Bertha Roberts, creating the kitchen corner where she had spent so much time. On one of them was a painting Ralph remembered well. It showed a family at supper. Dad, Mom, 2 kids. They were passing the potatoes and the corn and looked like they were discussing their respective days. None of them noticed that there was a 5th person in the room, a white-robed man with a sandy beard and long hair. He was standing in the corner and watching them. Christ, the unseen visitor, the plaque beneath this painting read. Except the Christ Ralph remembered had looked both kind and a little embarrassed to be eavesdropping. This version, however, looked coldly thoughtful, evaluative, judgmental perhaps, and his color was very high, almost choleric, as if he had heard something which had made him furious. Mom, are you... She put the needles down again on the red blanket, that oddly shiny red blanket, and raised a hand to stop him.
Mom, me no moms, Ralph. Just pay attention and mind. Stay out of this. It's too late for your muddling and meddling. You can only make things worse.
The voice was right, but the face was wrong and becoming wronger. Mostly it was her skin, smooth and unlined. Her skin had been Bertha Roberts's only vanity. The skin of the creature in the rocker was rough. More than rough, in fact. It was scaly. And there were 2 growths, or perhaps they were sores, on the sides of her neck. At the sight of them, some terrible memory.
Get it off me, Johnny. Oh, please, get it off!
Stirred far down in his mind. And, well, her aura. Where was her aura?
Never mind my aura. And never mind about that fat old whore you've been running around with. Although I'll bet Carolyn is just rolling in her grave.
The mouth of the woman, not a woman, that thing is not a woman, in the rocker was no longer small. The lower lip had spread, puffed outward and downward. The mouth itself had developed a drooping sneer, a strangely familiar drooping sneer.
Johnny, it's biting me, it's biting me.
Something horridly familiar about the bunches of whiskers bristling at the corners of the mouth, too.
Johnny, please, it's eyes, it's black eyes.
Johnny can't help you, boy. He didn't help you then, and he can't help you now.
Of course he couldn't. His older brother Johnny had died 6 years ago. Ralph had been a pallbearer at his funeral. Johnny had died of a heart attack, possibly as random as the one which had felled Bill McGovern, and... Ralph looked to the left,
but the pilot's side of the cockpit had also disappeared, and Ed Deepnow with it. Ralph saw the old combination gas and wood stove on which his mother had cooked in the house on Richmond Street, a job she had resented bitterly and done badly all her life, and the arch leading into the dining room. He saw their maple dining table. A glass pitcher stood in the center of it. The pitcher had been filled with a choke of lurid red roses. Each seemed to have a face, a blood-red, gasping face. But that's wrong, he thought. All wrong. She'd never had roses in the house. She was allergic to most blooms, and roses were the worst. She used to sneeze like crazy when she was around them. The only thing I ever saw her put on the dining room table was Indian bouquet, and that wasn't anything but autumn grasses. I see roses because... He looked back at the creature in the rocking chair, at red fingers which had now melted together into appendages that looked almost like fins. He regarded the scarlet mass which lay in the creature's lap, and the scar along his arm began to tingle again. What in God's name is going on here? But he knew, of course. He only had to look from the red thing in the rocking chair to the picture hanging on the wall, the picture of the scarlet-faced, malevolent Jesus watching the family eat their supper, to confirm it. He was not in his old house in Marymead, and he was not precisely in an aircraft over Derry either. He was in the court of the Crimson King. Without thinking about why he was doing it, Ralph slipped a hand into his sweater pocket and loosely cupped one of Lois's earrings. His hand felt far away, something which belonged to someone else. He was realizing an interesting thing. He had never been frightened in his life until now. Not once. He had thought he'd been frightened, of course, but it had been an illusion. The only time he'd even come close had been in the Derry Public Library, when Charlie Pickering stuck a knife into his armpit and said he was going to let Ralph's guts out all over the floor. That, however, was nothing but a mild moment of discomfort next to what he was feeling now. A green man came. He felt good, but I could be wrong. He hoped she wasn't. He most sincerely hoped she wasn't, because the green man was about all he had left now. The green man and Lois's earrings.
Ralph, stop wool gathering. Look at your mother when she's talking to you. 70 years old, and you still act like you were 16, with a bad case of pecker rash.
He turned back to the red-finned thing slumped in the rocker. It now bore only a passing resemblance to his late mother.
You're not my mother, and I'm still in the airplane.
You're not, boy. Don't make the mistake of thinking you are. Take one step out of my kitchen and you're in for a very long fall.
You might as well stop now. I can see what you are.
The thing spoke in a bubbly, choked voice that turned Ralph's spine to a narrow line of ice.
You don't. You may think you do, but you don't. And you don't want to. You don't ever want to see me with my disguises laid aside. Believe me, Ralph, you don't.
He realized with mounting horror that the mother thing had turned into an enormous female catfish, a hungry bottom feeder with stubby teeth gleaming between its pendulous lips and whiskers which dangled almost to the collar of the dress it still wore. The gills in its neck opened and closed like razor cuts, revealing troubled red inner flesh. Its eyes had grown round and purplish, and as Ralph watched, the sockets began to slide away from each other. This continued until the eyes bulged from the sides rather than the front of the creature's scaly face.
Don't move so much as a single muscle, Ralph. You'll probably die in the explosion, no matter what level you're on. The shock waves travel here just as they do in any building. But that death will still be a great deal better than my death.
The catfish opened its mouth. Its teeth ringed a blood-colored maw, which looked full of strange guts and tumors. It seemed to be laughing at him. "Who are you? Are you the Crimson King?"
"That's Ed's name for me. We ought to have our own, don't you think? Let's see. If you don't want me to be Mom Roberts, why not call me the Kingfish? You remember the Kingfish from the radio, don't you?"
Yes, of course he did. But the real Kingfish had never been on Amos and Andy, and it hadn't really been a Kingfish at all. The real Kingfish had been a Queenfish, and it had lived in the Barrens. On a summer's day during the year when Ralph Roberts was 7, he had hooked an enormous catfish out of the Kanduskeag while fishing with his brother John. This had been when it was still possible to eat what you caught down in the Barrens. Ralph had asked his older brother to take the convulsively flopping thing off his hook for him and put it in the bucket of fresh water they kept on the bank beside them. Johnny had refused, loftily citing what he called the fisherman's creed. Good fishermen tie their own flies, dig their own worms, and unhook their own catches. It was only later that Ralph realized Johnny might have been trying to hide his own fear of the huge and somehow alien creature his kid brother had reeled out of the Kanduskeag's muddy, piss-warm water that day. Ralph had at last brought himself to grasp the catfish's pulsing body, which was at the same time slick, scaly, and prickly. As he did, Johnny had added to his terror by telling him in a low and ominous voice to look out for the whiskers.
"They're poisoned. Bobby Therold told me if one of them sticks in you, you could get paralyzed, spend the rest of your life in a wheelchair. So be careful, Ralphie."
Ralph had twisted the creature this way and that, trying to free the hook from its dark, wet innards without getting his hand too near its whiskers, not believing Johnny about the poison, and at the same time believing him completely. Exquisitely aware of the gills, the eyes, the fishy smell that seemed to shimmer its way more deeply into his lungs each time he inhaled. At last he'd heard a gristly ripping from deep within the catfish and felt the hook start to slide free. Fresh streamlets of blood trickled from the corners of its flexing, dying mouth. Ralph gave a little sigh of relief, prematurely as it turned out. The catfish gave a tremendous flap of its tail as the hook came out. The hand Ralph had been using to free it slipped, and all at once the catfish's bleeding mouth clamped shut on his first two fingers. How much pain had there been? A lot? Some? Maybe none at all? Ralph couldn't remember. What he did remember was Johnny's completely unfeigned shriek of horror and his own surety that the catfish was going to make him pay for taking its life by eating two fingers off his right hand. He remembered screaming himself and shaking his hand and begging Johnny to help him. But Johnny had been backing away, his face pale, his mouth a knotted line of revulsion. Ralph shook his hand in big swooping arcs, but the catfish hung on like death. "Whiskers, poisoned whiskers, put me in a wheelchair for the rest of my life," snapping and flapping against Ralph's wrist, black eyes staring. At last he'd struck it against the nearby tree, breaking its back. It had dropped to the grass, still flopping, and Ralph had stamped on it with one foot, provoking the final horror. A spew of guts vomited from its mouth, and from the place where Ralph's heel had smashed it open had come a gluey torrent of bloody eggs. That was when he had realized that the kingfish had really been the queenfish, and only a day or two from rowing. Ralph had stared from this freakish mess to his own bloody scale-encrusted hand, and then howled like a banshee. When Johnny touched his arm in an effort to calm him, Ralph had bolted. He hadn't stopped running until he got home, and he'd refused to come out of his room for the rest of the day. It had been almost a year before he'd eaten another piece of fish, and he never had anything to do with catfish again. Until now, that was. "Ralph?" That was Lois's voice, but distant, so distant. "You have to do something right away. Don't let it stop you." Ralph now realized that what he'd taken for an Afghan in his mother's lap was actually a mat of bloody eggs in the lap of the Crimson King. It was leaning toward him over this throbbing blanket, its thick lips quivering in a parody of concern.
"Something wrong, Ralphie?"
Where does it hurt? Tell Mother.
You're not my mother.
No, I be the queenfish. I be loud and I be proud. I got the walk and I got the talk. Actually, I can be whatever I want. You may not know it, but shape-changing is a time-honored custom in Derry.
Do you know the green man Lois saw?
Of course. I know all the neighborhood folks.
But Ralph sensed momentary puzzlement on that scaly face. The heat along his forearm cranked up another notch, and Ralph had a sudden realization. If Lois were here now, she would hardly be able to see him. The queenfish was putting out a pulsing, ever-brightening glow, and it was gradually surrounding him. The glow was red instead of black, but it was still a death bag, and now he knew what it was like to be on the inside, caught in a web woven from your sickest fears and most traumatic experiences. There was no way to retreat from it, and no way to cut through it, as he had cut through the death bag which had surrounded Ed's wedding ring. If I'm going to escape, Ralph thought, I'm going to have to do it by running forward so hard and fast I rip right out the other side. The earring was still in his hand. Now he shifted it so that the naked prong at the back was sticking out between the two fingers a catfish had tried to swallow 63 years ago. Then he said a brief prayer, not to God, but to Lois's green man.